San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you live from KFMB. You can hear us with 50,000 watts of power up and down the coast, up to Seattle on a good night, out to Cabo, out to the desert. There's an app for 760 KFMB. You can hear us online at 760kfmb.com. And now time to introduce the main man of the hour. He's a CPA extraordinaire. He's an accomplished marathon runner. He is a family man and all-around good guy. He is a best-selling author and a philanthropist, and his name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you tonight? You family office expert as well.
I'm doing great, Joe. I'm doing the basketball thing all weekend.
You went from tennis to basketball, but boy,
tennis to basketball.
Is everybody delirious? It was so great coming in because there's nobody on the freeways. I think everybody who watched
the Aztec game wrapped up around 5:15.
Well, everybody's partying, I'm sure.
Yeah,
I'd love to have the beer concession.
They held the best shooting team in the nation at 51% to 31% shooting.
Isn't that unbelievable?
That's great.
Isn't that
so Anaheim next weekend, probably Arizona. Winner of Arizona, Gonzaga tomorrow goes against the Aztecs.
Yeah. Boy, I'll tell you how exciting. They ran away with this. 19 points they beat them by. I mean, it's...
And everybody, if you want to see me on TV tomorrow, I'm sitting right behind the south bench for both games. I mean, right behind the bench. I must have gotten 50 texts yesterday.
You mean for the at Viejas Arena?
Yeah, there's the game at 4:10, which is Stephen F. Austin against UCLA, and then there's the game around 6:50, which will be Gonzaga, Arizona, and I'm sitting right behind the bench.
All right.
So I got 50 texts. Everybody said, what are you doing sitting behind the bench? I wrote back, I'm watching basketball. What do you think I'm doing?
Anyway, had a pretty cool... I saw this in the paper. Your book, this was in...
About a week and a half ago.
Yes. Yeah. The number one book at Warwick's, the top seller, was a book by Richard Muzio. So what's your play?
Yeah, number one book at the number one bookstore in all of San Diego County. Yeah. That would be Warwick's on Girard in La Jolla.
Of course, everyone knows you were Bobby Riggs, as a 14, 15-year-old Bobby Riggs scrapbook maker, and that is the same bookstore where you bought those scrapbooks in 1971,
I bought all the supplies to make those books 41 years ago at Warwick's.
Well, your mother...
Now I'm number one on the... Well, my mom had to drive me. I was only 14.
All the way from East County, right?
All the way from Lakeside.
And if you go up to the Bobby Riggs Museum, you can see those scrapbooks. And there's one in the Tennis Hall of Fame, right?
That's correct.
Yes. Hey, another cool thing. I knew Lauren Ann Carroll fairly well. I'm sure you bumped in when you worked at this station. And I have been his son. He's got one son and two daughters. And his son, Graham... has a country western band, and they were playing Lestat's West last night. So I made it a point to get down there, and we had a little chat after his set, and he gave me one of his CDs. And I want to tell you, they are pretty darn good. I was only dedicated this to his father, Lauren Ann Carroll. This is called Heart, his album. But Nan Carroll, I'm not a big country western fan, but I tell you, after watching those guys, they're a lot of fun. I could listen to them for a long time. So
cool stuff. Speaking of sons, I want to wish my son Evan a happy 23rd birthday, which is today, March 22.
Wow.
So Evan,
cool.
I love you. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Evan.
Also, my brother Bob just had a birthday. I'm not going to say his age out in public, but that was a few days ago. So happy birthday to my brother Bob.
Now, you've got one son, two daughters too, right? Just like Lauren. Excellent. Yeah. Okay. But anyway, that's cool. And I went to this Meeting of the Minds thing that Voice of San Diego put on the other night, Dot Liberty Station. That was a lot of fun. So,
but here's my trivia question for the night, Joe. My brother asked me this question. I got 3/4 of it right. Our guests can join in if they think they know the answer. It's a geography question. Can you name the states in this country, respectively, that are furthest east, west, north, and south?
Oh, my God. Well, Alaska north, south Hawaii, east Maine, and... What did I say? West?
You got to do west.
West Hawaii. West Hawaii, right?
No, okay. Here's the answer, okay? Hawaii is the south, southernmost state.
Oh, Hawaii's south, okay.
But the most northern, the most eastern, and the most western state is Alaska.
Oh, okay.
Because Alaska is on both sides of the dateline.
Okay, thank you for that useless information.
Thank you. I got 3 out of 4 right, so I was proud.
Oh, good. Well, we got a very important guest tonight, and first off, I have to thank our friend Jeffrey Krinsk and Marcy. Jeffrey recommended this gentleman to us, and I didn't even hesitate when he recommended him. But we're going to have a really cool show tonight because we're going to deal in something I don't think we've touched upon yet, and it's intellectual property. And this gentleman founded a firm called Consor. They're right in beautiful downtown La Jolla. He's been at it 25 years, how to monetize IP, and he's an author of 5 books, working on a 6th. And without further ado, which I don't like to use that. That's without further delay, let me introduce Mr. Wes Anson. Wes, good evening. How are you?
Good evening. And can you hear me okay in the control room?
No, we can't. Justin, you got him turned up there? Keep talking, Wes.
Yeah. I have a yellow light on my cough button that won't turn off.
Oh, okay. Oh, no, leave that alone. Leave that alone. Don't touch that.
Right.
Okay.
Now you can hear me, I hope.
I wish that was IP so you couldn't touch it. Yeah.
If it's mechanical, don't let me touch it. I'll value it for you, but don't let me run it. The first lesson of engineering and myself, intellectual property is what we do, in fact, and it covers everything from trademarks and copyrights to... Mm-hmm. Very, very complicated patents and trade secrets. The thing to learn about intellectual property quickly is let's try to divide it into two sections. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about corporate intellectual property, mm-hmm. and let's talk about personal intellectual property.
Okay.
Are you getting me?
Yeah.
Good.
Wes, before we do that, though, can we talk about who you are?
Sure.
Yeah, let's get into your background.
Let's talk about who you are.
All
first.
Right, let's do it.
So who are you? Why are you here?
You know, it's funny. When my father said to me, "You're going to study intellectual property," he said, "Why are you doing that?" I said, "Because it's the future." And this is, of course, 40 years ago.
Sure.
He says, "It's the future." And he says, "Well, tell me what the future's about." And I said, "The future's about ideas." I said, "Because in this country, we make ideas. We don't need to build factories in America anymore. In fact, they build factories a lot cheaper in Thailand and other countries. But what we do better than anywhere else is we build ideas, and that's what intellectual property is. Mm-hmm. It's ideas,
mm-hmm.
and whether that idea takes the form of a new brand name, that's an idea. Whether it takes the form of a patent for a new cell phone, that's an idea.
Trademark,
so,
right?
And whether it's a trademark, that's an idea. And so that's what we do for a living. We make sure that we understand how much a piece of intellectual property is worth.
So born and raised where though, Wes?
I'm sorry. Born in the Chicago area, and okay. then I lived overseas for a number of years, mm-hmm. in Asia, learning a lot about intellectual property and the fact that developing countries need our intellectual property.
Mm-hmm. Where'd you go to school in terms of college?
High school and college.
I went to Northwestern University.
Oh, okay.
Well, good
and,
school.
And then I went to Harvard, went to the business school, got an honors degree there, went to law school for a year, and I found out I didn't want to be a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
All my siblings are lawyers.
You had an interesting story about being a year behind George Bush before the show.
Yeah,
you ran the paper and he ran the bar, right?
It's true. We at the business school, I ran the newspaper along with Michael Cuban and George Bush was ahead of us, and he ran the pub, and he was very good at it. I will say that
did it turn that, a profit
that. We don't know how much money he made, but we do know that he had an awfully good time at his job,
mm-hmm.
and was there every afternoon contributing to his own profits. But after leaving Harvard, I then was with a large consulting firm in New York called Booz Allen and Hamilton,
mm-hmm.
and from there got recruited to a large publishing company, and my job there was to take that publishing company and its magazine and take it out all around the world and license it. In other words, let other people use that title, mm-hmm. of that magazine and the photographs in that magazine and take it to Brazil and Japan and Germany and Spain and France. And of course, that magazine was Playboy.
Okay.
And so that was, I think, for a young fella in his very early 30s, probably one of the most fun jobs you could have had
Good.
In that day and age.
We're having a little bit of technical difficulty. Let's take our first break right now and see if we can get these microphones cleaned up. But we'll come right back with more of It's Your Money in Your Life right after this. Hang on.
It's Your Money and Your Life on AM 760 KFMB.
All right, we're back with more of It's Your Money, Your Life with the president and CEO of Consor Intellectual Property Firm in La Jolla. His name is Wes Anson, and when we left off, he was talking about his job at Playboy right after college, right?
Right after graduate school.
And
it was, as I say, it was a fantastic job and had some interesting stories to go with it. I remember we were going over to Japan to launch the edition of the magazine, and I was one of the two people in charge. So we were taking the bunny plane, as it was called.
Oh my gosh! How old were you, Wes, at this time?
I was 32. And so I'm taking the bunny plane with one of the other really senior executives. I was a vice president, but the executive vice president myself. And we took with us a Playmate of the Year, and we took either 6 or 8 bunnies with us.
Were all the flight attendants dressed in the bunny?
Oh, absolutely. This was the age of
Mad Men.
Right. It really was. It was Mad Men all over again. And so we get to Japan, and we have the grand opening, and we've got a problem. It comes quite clear, and I'm going to have to handle the problem because our partners, who are a very large publishing firm, whom I can't name, obviously, on the air, they were making the assumption that the bunnies, in addition to being the hostesses for the opening of the party, were also there for another reason, they assumed. And so they were coming to me trying to book appointments. And so I go to my boss, who's the executive vice president, and I say to him, I said, Peter, what do I do? He says, well, this is not, you obviously know, this is not something that we ever allow. He says, you're just going to have to tell them. And I says, but these are men in their 60s. These are white-haired senior executives in Japan. He says, I don't care what you tell them. I'm your boss, and I'm telling you to do it. Just take care of it. So there I was, 32-year-old man, telling these very nice white-haired old Japanese gentlemen that they could not sleep with the bunnies. I think that's the end of that story, however.
You should have started taking bids, but...
So, Joe, I'm going to tell 2 Playboy stories.
All right. Here's
the first one. This is not in my book, so what's your play? But Bobby Riggs's brother, John Riggs, my uncle, had a vintage collection of Playboy magazines dating back from literally the original issue. But his wife, my Auntie Bun, would not let him keep them at his house, so he kept them in the basement of my grandmother's garage at her house in San Francisco, which I became aware of when I was 9 or 10. And then the second story is because, you know, I made Bobby Riggs' scrapbooks. Probably the most prolific scrapbook maker on this planet is actually Hugh Hefner. He is a huge producer of his own scrapbooks on a weekly basis.
Yes.
He works with his then-current wife of the week or month. Since that changes frequently, he actually makes scrapbooks. And he's got a huge, huge self-made scrapbook collection, reputed to be the largest self-made scrapbook collection on the planet.
He's also, if I can add to that, he's also one of the most forward-thinking people I've ever worked with. Even back when he was in his 60s and 70s, I haven't talked to him in 3 or 4 years now, but he was talking about social media 10, 15 years ago when people in their 70s didn't even know how to spell social media. Mm-hmm. And that's been the secret of that man's survival when all other people in that business have failed. But that's just one aspect of intellectual property. And Richard, you know, I don't want to get
Talk about Marilyn Monroe a little bit too, because that was interesting.
That is interesting. Maybe that's a good way to segue.
let's get out of this playmate thing. So
she was the first playmate.
That great photo of her on the red velvet background. Those rights no longer belong to her because she died. Those are called rights of publicity when you use the reproduction rights of something like that. And I'm writing a book currently on rights of publicity for the American Bar Association. But because she died in New York, there are no posthumous rights of publicity. Therefore, she can't own those rights. And so those rights are now owned by the photographer who took the photograph. There are 2 morals to this story. If you have a well-known aunt or uncle, make sure that just before they go, you move them to New Jersey. That's number one. And number two, if you do have anyone in your family that is well-known, be sure that they're protecting their rights of publicity, because anytime someone uses their image in a photograph or an advertisement or God forbid, on a product, those are very valuable rights for which they should be compensated.
Are you sure she died in New York? Because I seem to recall she died in L.A., right?
Well, you're absolutely right. Physically, she died in L.A., but they made a statement in her will when she drafted it up several years before she died that she made a specific statement that regardless of where she might live, she forever considered herself a citizen of world and specifically of New York.
Wow. And by doing that, her estate, although she had no offspring, did she have any heirs at all?
She does have a daughter, Miss Miracle. I'm trying to remember if it's Marilyn Miracle. I believe it's Marilyn Miracle is her name.
Oh, you know, you're right. I'm on on Wikipedia here. I don't, well, I see spouses. I don't know if she had any, I don't see if any children, but maybe she did.
That's been a relatively recent development.
Oh, okay.
but the point there is because she declared herself to be a New York resident, even though she lived and died in Brentwood, the law declares her a New York resident, therefore no rights of publicity.
Interesting. Well, we should mention your books here, Intellectual. I don't know if I...
five books that are preceding this one that's going to be coming out soon?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
We've got intellectual property. What's that third word? Valuation?
Valuation.
Mm-hmm. IP valuation and management. The Intangible Assets Handbook. The Attorney's Guide to the Business Mind. And Expert Witnesses, Valuation and Damages, the Expert's Point of View. And the new one coming out is about the right of publicity.
Right of publicity. And I will urge you all to, when you're reading these, to read them sitting upright as as there's a possibility they might put you to sleep. But they are valuable in terms of the knowledge they contain.
Well, if you've got, you know, some intellectual property, these are things you probably want to look into or consult with you or get a hold of your firm. Now, you've got a guy, Mr. Iger, working at your firm, right? Any relation to the Disney CEO?
Distant. Mark runs our New York office, and that's very, very, very clever of you to look that up. Mm-hmm. Mark is an attorney, and although he calls himself a recovering attorney, and runs our New York office. Uh-huh. We have done a fair amount of work for Disney when his distant cousin was in charge. They've gone through a lot of change at Disney. Mm-hmm. They've grown quite a bit, and they own intellectual property that extends from Winnie the Pooh and now Star Wars to the original core Disney properties.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably have as much, now they probably have as diverse a group of intellectual property as any company on the trademark and brand side.
Well, Bob Iger, I think he is still the chair and CEO from what I can tell.
Yes, he is.
Quite a sharp guy. I think he was originally with ABC or something but prior to that, though. So from Playboy, you go to... I guess head of licensing for Playboy. So any other stories you'd like to talk about there, Wes?
No, Joe, we've segued away from Playboy.
Oh, we did?
Yeah, okay. We did. The Marilyn Monroe story was the segue.
I segued back, but anyway.
Yeah, so you're going to segue away.
Okay.
That's why they call it segue.
Yeah, let's get into Hang 10 Clothing then. You were president of Hang 10 for a good deal, right?
Yes, and actually chief operating officer was the actual title.
Mm-hmm.
Back when Hang 10 was the biggest brand on the beach, both here and overseas, and we had companies operating under the Hang 10 name, ranging from Denmark and Germany all the way down to New Zealand. We had licensees, they're called. And a licensee is a company or an individual who takes the right to use your intellectual property for a given period of time in a given geography for a given product or service. Very simple concept,
mm-hmm.
Sort of like renting a piece of property. And we had over 100 licenses scattered along 32 countries when I left to start this firm.
You guys did more than just clothing, though, right? Going from memory?
We were everything from surfboards, of course,
right,
which is how we started.
Sunglasses, T-shirts, all of it.
T-shirts, tennis rackets.
Really?
We're the second biggest roller skate brand in America at the time. We'd built it into quite a brand, and then a Chinese company came along and made a very decent offer to the Ratner family, and you know they were a family that they are a family that's been very socially conscious here in San Diego and contributed to quite a number of good causes in the city.
So Hang 10 was based in San Diego?
Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm. Wow, how about that?
And the Ratners were the primary owners of the company.
Outstanding. I did not know that. So you, how many years were you there from when to when?
I was there for 4 years. Let's see, 22 years ago. So I guess I left in about 1990 and 89 and started up this company.
So Consor, the title comes from what?
Well, it's because we are good consultants, we hired a consulting firm to help us come up with a name that A, could be registered everywhere in the world, because it's important that you can clear the name in every language.
Huh.
That's not easy to do.
Huh.
And we wanted to have a name that at least implied coming together. So a consortium, a consortia, mm-hmm. consor, and consor, C-O-N-S-O-R, is not a real word, mm-hmm. not a real word in any of the Latin or Slavic languages.
Huh.
So we're able to register it in every language
in the
world.
So it's like Xerox or something
exactly.
else where you could...
Which is a client of ours, by the way. And I've got to be... I hate to say this. I've got to be in Rochester on Wednesday.
Really?
Yes.
And you're on a flight tomorrow. Where are you heading tomorrow?
I'm going to Montreal tomorrow.
Montreal. So.
Yeah, so...
Anyway, we're coming up on our next break right now. We'll come back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life after news, sports, and weather. So hang on.
Here for Career Day...
All right, we're back with the second half of It's Your Money and Your Life. And over to Richard to thank our sponsors.
Thank you, sponsors. Michael Karancher and Drew Freitas at UBS. Couldn't do it without you guys. Thanks again for the tennis tickets a week ago Friday. Every Friday, I end up goofing off all day long doing something fun. It was tennis a week ago Friday, basketball yesterday. And it's been a blast. Brenda Geiger with the law offices of Brenda Geiger, asset protection and estate planning. Jason Kruger, the best CFO service. Here in San Diego with Signature Analytics. Thank you very much. Right across the street from UBS in downtown La Jolla, San Diego's best business bank, Regions Bank, Mr. Steve Sefton, Sean Puckett. Our favorite CPAs on the planet, Don Epic CPA and Paul Polito CPA. They've got plenty of extra time to participate in my basketball pool, which, Joe, you never sent me your picks, which is probably smart because the rest of us weren't so smart, apparently. My email today to everybody, including the boys at Polito Epic, was nobody, please give up your day job because you're not going to make any money doing this. Joel Grushkin with Cost Segregation Initiatives, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow. Carl Sheeler with Berkeley Research Group, helping business owners improve the values of their business by understanding the risks that drive the values of their business. And last but not least, the Lombardi Group and the LG Experience, helping CPAs and wealth advisors become the key, most trusted advisor to their very best clients. Joe, how can our listeners find out about our amazing roster of sponsors who are not only so good to us, but do excellent, excellent work for all the folks that they represent?
Well, if they fire up their computer or their smartphone, they can get on iymoney.com. There is a drop-down menu there. Just put your cursor on sponsors, and you will find all their information there, their phone numbers, emails, bios, everything else. And I know that they've worked with you for several years with great results in every area, right?
Yeah, I probably saw half of them on projects last week alone.
Wow.
When I wasn't, you know, going to tennis matches and basketball games.
So it's personal testimonial here. Didn't get these folks out of the phone book. They're colleagues and collaborators of Richard.
Of a long time in many cases.
Time, so.
Yeah. Anyway.
Anyway.
Hey, Wes, question. I know you've got an office on the East Coast. You've got an office on the West Coast. Between the two coasts, are there sort of differences in what you see in the intellectual property marketplace?
Very much so. A couple of dimensions. Let's stick to the corporate side of it.
Sure.
Let's put aside the individual side. Number one, I'll make this statement. American industry in general finds that more than 80% of its value is tied up in intellectual property. That's a general statement. On the West Coast, where we are, and particularly in San Diego, San Francisco, and the Bay Area in general, you'll find that 95% of the value of companies is tied up in intellectual property.
Huh.
On the East Coast, you still have more traditional industries. We've still got, let's face it, they're still making coal back there. And you don't need a lot of intellectual property to dig ore out of the ground. The other difference you find, or that I find in working with intellectual property, is that Eastern companies are, believe it or not, slower to adopt to new technologies. They're also slower to freshening of their IP. They'll continue to use older IP when newer IP is available. And I don't know whether that's simply a product of our national psyche. I think it is.
What would be an example of new old IP versus new IP?
Well, let's use, for example, let's stay with the extractive industries. You'll find that the in my view, the oil companies that are headquartered on the East Coast are far less adaptive and aggressive in bringing on new extractive intellectual property mm-hmm. than West Coast based companies,
mm-hmm.
and we've just gone through a we've just gone through a major case where, I hate to digress, but this is interesting, I think. Chevron was sued in Ecuador for $16 billion. And $16 billion is a lot of money, even to an oil company. And we were able to successfully defend them. Now, what had happened was the Ecuadorian government impounded all of their intellectual property in Ecuador and was going to sell it on the world market.
Hmm. Chevron, what do you mean, like their signage and everything?
Their trademarks, their brands, some of their technology.
Huh.
And in a most unusual case. And I bring this up as a segue away from your earlier question, mm-hmm. Richard, but to illustrate the fact that intellectual property can be enormously important, because Ecuador couldn't get satisfaction from Chevron. They felt they were wronged because Chevron doesn't have any bank accounts in Ecuador. So what did they do? They turned to the intellectual property that the oil company was using in that country and impounded that. Because you don't have to physically impound anything. You just go down to the Ecuador trademark office, mm-hmm. take the registrations, and sign them over to the Ecuadorian government. And suddenly, Chevron no longer owns its trademarks or its patents.
So they basically can't operate.
Right, exactly.
In the country.
Huh. And so my point here in making this segue is that intellectual property can be of great value, but can also be very vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to get into politics. I was about to get into the Russian-Ukrainian situation.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a point of vulnerability that we can use with the Russians, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not go there. Let's stick with intellectual property.
But it's definitely worth addressing. Now, we were talking a little about Facebook at the break, and you wanted to, since a lot of people are familiar with
it. How much was the market cap, Joe? Did you look it up?
Well, the IPO when they launched was, the market cap was $100 billion.
Okay. So that's not in furniture and fixtures.
No, but and then of course this WhatsApp bought for $19 billion. But you wanted to make some comments or share some thoughts.
Well,
about
my
that.
Question to us is, how on earth do you value something like a Facebook?
Well, Facebook is a little bit easier than WhatsApp. WhatsApp is just brand new on the street. I mean, they just came marching out of the woods here in raggedy clothes 2 years ago. But let's talk about Facebook first. Mm-hmm. There you have the ability to at least take a look at their user base. How many people do they have? How quickly are they growing? What's their future projections of penetration rates? How quickly are they going to get from 5 million to 10 million to 20 million to 50 million users? So you've got some markers. You've got some standards that you can use for valuation purposes. And you can begin to see at the time of the IPO for Facebook the growth in revenue,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and it's growing very quickly now. I think we all, in the break, were talking about that.
They're about $7.8 billion in revenue right now.
Right, and that's up from a little over $1 billion a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
So that rate of growth is substantial. That valuation mechanism can be put in place. You can do that valuation if that's your business, and for us, that is our business. The one that's more difficult is WhatsApp. I mean, on the way down here, Dave Satimi, who's sitting here in the room with us, our general manager, we were talking about this, and here we're puzzling over whether someone has bought this WhatsApp because it may have some incredibly effective trade secrets in terms of the kind of the code that they're using, because $19 billion for a company that hasn't a penny in revenue, has a still relatively small user base, is a very large price to pay. So we're not sure how they valued that purchase price. And we can only speculate it's for assets that we don't have access to.
Or they're projecting some massive growth in Asia or something like that. But even then,
sorry to interrupt you, I apologize. But even then, that growth would have to be massive and quick.
Well, maybe it's a lot of hype. I don't know.
It could very well be.
I worked for mp3.com for a year, and we had a wonderful IPO, and I was gone after a year, and so was everybody else.
We just got done valuing MySpace. Remember MySpace?
Sure. Oh, yeah.
You'd be surprised at how little it's worth today. In fact, I can arrange for you to buy that, and you can probably afford it.
What was its value at its peak?
I think the value of
if you had peak, to guess
was about $6.5 to $7.5 billion.
Wow.
But honestly, I can get financing. You can drive it away tomorrow.
MySpace.
Wow.
You can own MySpace.
We'll change the name to Richard Space.
Wow.
And it'd probably go up in value.
Yeah,
if
probably
you did.
Would. Yeah.
Wow. Anyway, let's hold that thought, though, Wes, because this is great. We'll come right back with the last segment of It's Your Money, the award-winning show, It's Your Money, Your Life, right after this. Hang on.
Now, It's Your Money and Your Life on AM 760 KFMB.
All right, we are in the home stretch with the chairman of Consor, consor.com, C-O-N-S-O-R. This guy knows everything about IP, intellectual property, and his email. Well, he's Wes Anson, of course, and his email is wanson, A-N-S-O-N, at consor.com in beautiful downtown La Jolla on Girard there. So,
hey, Wes, a question. I last week, my youngest daughter, who's 17 and still doesn't drive, so I'm her chauffeur. After school, we went into a smoothie place that's really good to buy a smoothie or two. And I won't mention any names, but the smoothie place has a really cute four-word slogan that's not the name of the business. And I did some investigation, and they haven't done any protection, as far as I can tell, of their really neat forward slogan. So can you explain to us how IP relates to, shall we say, our average listener, somebody who owns one or two smoothie stores, for example?
That's funny. That's right on the money. Because during the break, we were saying, how does IP affect the average business? That is a perfect example. That smoothie store, even if it's just two stores, is probably driving 10% of their business through
this. Yeah, and they're busy. I mean, these guys are busy.
And that needs to be copyrighted and trademarked as quickly as they can. And it's a relatively small expense. And once they do that, they've protected that slogan.
Or they'll be licensing it for me.
Right. Or you can buy the first license for your daughter.
Right.
And she can open up two stores. But once they do that, they've protected that IP for essentially forever, as long as they renew it every 10 years. So,
But do most businesses, small business owners, even think about this in your experience?
Not often enough. Often what happens is a small business owner will come to us and say, I've been running a successful business. This is a true story. I've been running the successful business for 7 years, doing about $1.5 million a year in sales, very profitable. Apple Computer has just called us and told us that we have to shut down tomorrow because they've just registered our trademark. Mm-hmm. And what am I going to do? They say to me. And I say to them, well, what you're going to do, first of all, is you're going to call this lawyer right here. Mm-hmm. And together we're going to go to Apple and say, this client, this small company, has been in business a long time and we're going to fight you. But Apple makes I don't want to overstate this. Large companies make a habit of preying on small companies that have successful unregistered trademarks and copyrights. Mm-hmm. And then going to those small companies and saying, sorry, we just registered your trademark. You're out of business now.
I got a cool story. There, Lestat's Coffee House, they on the menu, one of the specialty drinks is an Almond Joy. One day, a letter from Hershey, Pennsylvania shows up. You can't use Almond Joy anymore. I said, oh, what the heck? Well, they name it after me, Almond Joey. So that's...
Joe, you're a nut. So that was very appropriate.
That's a great solution.
And it's a damn good drink, except I'm cutting down on sugar now. But anyway, there you go.
But to finish the answer that you both asked, really, to the question of, why does the average business person care? Well, number one, they probably have intellectual property and they don't realize it, whether it's a trademark or a copyright. Number two, if they do realize it, they may not realize how much it's worth, and it may be worth having a value put on it, because if it's valuable enough, it's a source of bank balance sheet financing. They can borrow against it, put it on their balance sheet, or they can sell it if it really mm-hmm. has value. So those are the two primary reasons to be concerned.
Now, websites, you get all these squatters took up all these company names, the .coms early on, and you heard of people making a fortune now. Isn't there some kind of tribunal that doesn't allow that, or how does that work?
Yeah, two good things have happened. Two good things have happened. Number one, it's much harder to squat on somebody's site because there's a law that protects the rightful owner. Secondly, the way that searches work on the internet now, and again, if Dave were on the phone here or on the speakers with us, he'd tell you all about this. But searches now are much less keyed to the original domain name and much more keyed to the content that's actually on your site. Mm. So a squatter can't just come along and set up a phony site with nothing on it and divert traffic. Mm. He has to have real content. So that's less of a problem than it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago, fortunately. I would say the biggest problem today are people who are ripping off trademarks online and offline.
Hmm.
And you find a lot of that going on.
This phishing, these emails, folks, if you get an email from a bank, then you know you're not a, don't bank there, but they want your click here because someone, you know, they want a new account. Do not do, that's called phish, right? Do not, and they look really slick, right? Mm-hmm. You get any of these, Richard?
I get them all the time.
And mm-hmm. they, if you get an, with the logo, whether it's Chase or something, and I go, I don't even bank there, and I'm getting this thing, they want my information, you know, the heck with, I hope people.
But I get 400 emails a day, Joe, so I don't respond to any of them, as you notice.
But there must be a small percentage of people who, you know, make that mistake.
Sad but true.
Yeah, it's slightly off the market. Do not ever respond to the ones that come from places like Ethiopia, Kenya, and other African countries offering you $5 million if you just send them your social security number.
Hey, Wes, you're going to tell a story about the Beatles.
Talking about the Beatles, one of the things that that they, in the early days, didn't do as great a job of as they should have is keeping control of their intellectual property. And so there are a lot of photos that float around of them that have unclear ownership. And so if someone, we were talking offline, we were talking about someone that we all know that has interviews with the Beatles and some, mm-hmm. and some photos, and we're hoping that that person may be able to put together a book of Beatles reminiscences and photos, because the Beatles have, unlike some of the other major groups, have not had a good history of putting together their own history. Mm-hmm. They really haven't, unfortunately.
So there's obviously a market for that with the 50th anniversary. And you know, the Beatles played here in August of 66, I think, or 65. I know they played San Diego once. I think it was August of 65. I wasn't here then. Richard, how well you were here?
I moved here in 69. I was 10 years old.
Okay.
Well, so, Wes, you're in a field that's, well, much, much different than it was even 5 years ago, given how the world has become so much more based in intellectual capital. How do you see the intellectual property market changing over the next 3, 5, 10 years?
Boy, that's a great wrap-up topic. On the personal side, you're going to find much more awareness and protection of individuals' rights. That's an absolute. Even people like your pastor, mm-hmm. Or minister or rabbi, who will be protecting his or her speeches and pastoral messages. We find that happening right now. And on the corporate side, you're going to find that those companies who can develop new IP on their own in the form of patents, trade secrets, trademarks, and brands, those that can develop their own IP in-house will develop the most quickly. The third trend, in terms of consumer goods, is that retailing is going to continue to change very quickly. And the traditional retailer with the Macy's of the world are going to continue to change. Target is going to be the new model for retailing, where they'll have six-month periods of exclusives with different brands. Hmm. The brand will come in for 6 months. They'll have a boutique within Target, and then they'll leave. And the next brand will come in for 6 months and they'll leave.
And they'll get someone like Ellen to pitch something, or Will Ferrell,
And the old pattern where Macy's would have 50 brands and they'd carry them year-round, year after year, that's going to change very dramatically. Mm-hmm. And the face of retailing is going to change very quickly. Gerrard Street in La Jolla is going to look very different in 5 years than it does today.
Do you think we're going to have these drones delivering books or something from Amazon? I just can't believe there's going to be all these drones buzzing in the sky, dropping off gifts or presents. It's hard to believe, but
well, I actually do believe in 5 years that they will be using drones at Christmas time to deliver. UPS will be using drones.
Wow, that's going to be neat.
Absolutely,
with little reindeers and
a little drone comes down your chimney.
The drone is here, darling.
Oh, my gosh. I don't hear much about the Google cars that can drive themselves anymore. I guess I don't know what's going on with that, but they did demo those things too, right? They drive through via GPS, no driver.
Right, and in the European Union, they've just approved cars to drive themselves for delivery.
My 17-year-old daughter, who's learning how to drive, drives like there's no driver.
Well, she thinks you're driving, Dad.
Oh, okay.
But just to wrap up with one final thought on the future, in terms of how it affects consumers, it's this movement from bricks-and-mortar retailing and bricks-and-mortar brands mm-hmm. to online brands and online mm-hmm. retailing
mm-hmm.
And social media brands and social media retailing. Mm. That trend will continue to escalate.
Wow.
And it's going to substantially affect.
Wes, we have to thank you and wrap it up right there. Thanks so much for being our guest. Folks, get over to consor.com. And if you have any questions about IP at all, that's the company to talk with.
And go Aztecs next week.
Go Aztecs.
Go Aztecs, for sure.
Of course. Hey, next week, speaking of IP, we're going to have the CEO from Tower Paddleboards, who was on Shark Tank, Stephen Ayerstahl, and also the candidate for County DA, Bob Brewer. They will be with us next week. So have a good week. See you next week, folks. Good night.